Morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Siegel, Judge Riley. The Honorable Kevin Ross presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this virtual oral argument session, July 27, 2021. Counsel, just for the sake of the proceeding today and for our audio recording, we are not at the MJC. We are proceeding by Zoom platform. So, counsel, just so you're aware, our recording is not by video, it's only by audio. So please do follow our usual procedure of stating your name as you commence each leg of your argument so that the audio recording will help those who are listening keep track of who's making which argument. If there's any technological difficulty along the way, and there might be with voice or video, of either your own or your opponent or any member of the court, just let us know and we'll pause the proceedings so we can figure out the technology and make sure we're all proceeding with the same opportunity to hear and see each other. With that, counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel for rebuttal if you'd like to use that time. And counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may. And I should say, I guess I should announce it. The case that we're hearing is the case of Juarez versus State of Minnesota.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and all the judges this morning. Good morning, and it's nice to be with you. My name is Richard Dahl, and I'm the attorney for the appellant, Jose Santoya Juarez. And this morning I have a few things I just want to highlight from my brief. First of all, I've discussed two issues about whether this is admissible, the statement by Roxanne Otterness and the statements of the other people that I'm offering that the investigator went into, they're really being offered for corroboration, not the statement itself. So I want to back up just a little bit. Under 801-
I'm trying to understand. So then you are conceding that they're hearsay statements?
Well, they're out of court statements. I'm not conceding that Roxanne's statement is hearsay statement, because I think under 801D2 that the state is the agent or the alter ego of the victim. That issue has not been ruled on in Minnesota. It has been ruled on in other states. Some states consider that to be the case. Some states do not consider that to be the case. There is no case in Minnesota that I could find with, maybe there is, but I couldn't find it, Your Honor.
Except it seems that the victim denied that she ever made that statement because she said that he doesn't know how much pain he's caused her.
Well, I mean, let's just be honest. The victim also said she was willing to do a recorded statement, which indicates some element of maybe she's willing to come clean, and then all of a sudden she decides at the last second, oh, I can't do this because I might go to jail because I lied in court and put someone in prison. So I don't know that I think it cuts the other way from your argument. But the other section that I was using was 804B3, which is a declaration against interest. I think this clearly is a declaration against interest, which would be admissible. And if you look at the comments to Rule 804A, it says the definition of unavailability, which this is what the state argues, that the witness is unavailable, but or not unavailable because it's the victim. But it says here, the definition of unavailability indicates that the primary concern is the unavailable of the testimony and not necessarily the unavailability of the declarant. And obviously, since, as was discussed, even in, if you go to the statement of Roxanne Otterness taken on October 21st, 2017, she even notes in there on page 3, that right, and I did make the comment that someone's life was messing with, because when Megan was telling me all that, I said that if Sheila is not telling the truth, that's someone's life she's messing with, that they could go away for a while. And so she was basically saying, this is on page AA3 with the recorded statement by the private investigator. Right there, there's a statement that basically they recognize both all the witnesses involved here, Megan Onstad and Sheila Michaud, the alleged victim, that they could potentially go to jail if they lied. So, I mean, the other thing about the statement is everybody just looks at the memo, which is at AA4. But if you go back and you look at the statement in detail, there are a number of corroborating things which are required under 804B3. Corroboration is required. If you go to page AA1 of the transcript, Roxanne Otterness says, and sometime after that, the incident occurred on July 2nd, 2010. Sometime after that, you were visiting Sheila's aunt in New London, whose name is Deb Evanson, and Sheila happened to be there living with her, correct? So that is it's, in my mind, that's pretty good corroboration that they actually went to this lady's house, to her aunt's house, in a location. Oh, but
excuse me, does any of that matter? Because the victim was available. I mean, so 804, it doesn't apply. I mean, it just doesn't apply. She testified at the trial, so her testimony was available.
Well, I just addressed it in the comments of 804A, and 804A, like I said, the definition of unavailability indicates the primary concern is the unavailability of the testimony. The testimony is going to be unavailable. I'm not going to be able to get the testimony directly from the victim. The victim isn't going to say that.
Right. And but so, can I interrupt just for a minute?
Go ahead.
So if we read the rule the way you're suggesting, there is no hearsay anymore. It would all be swallowed by the exception, right? Because anytime you had an inconsistent out-of-court statement, that would be admissible because your argument is, well, the witness is available. And not only that, the testimony is available because the witness is testifying at trial. But this particular statement, they're not willing to testify to. So therefore, it comes in. I just think the exception swallows the rule then. Why is that not the case?
You can say that, but I mean, I think it's really unfair to defendants to try to say it that way because a rule, subsection 3, says statement against interest. It says a statement that was at the time of its making so far contrary to the declarant's pecuniary or proprietary interest. Okay, that's a very, very specific type of statement. And this is a statement we're talking about.
Well, Mr. Dahl, you're asking us to credit Megan Onstad's statement against everyone else's statement. So, but before we get to the statements, I think the more basic issue is whether or not your appeal is time barred. It seems to me that you are arguing that the statute of limitations, the 2 years starts to run from the filing of your habeas petition. Is that your argument? Because you're clearly outside the ruling by the Minnesota Supreme Court. And if that is your argument, do you have any case law to back up that argument?
Well, my reply brief says on page 2, I quote the statute specifically, Minnesota Statute Section 590.01, Subdivision 4C, specifically states, no petition for post-conviction relief may be filed more than 2 years after the existence of newly discovered evidence could not have been ascertained by the exercise of due diligence by the petitioner or petitioner's attorney. Okay, I don't know how my client could have ever discovered the testimony of Roxanne Otterness. Nobody knew that Roxanne Otterness was someone that was out there as a potential witness. My client didn't know that. Nobody did. The state didn't know that.
Okay, so Mr. Dahl, just to clarify, then you are not arguing, you still haven't answered my question about when you think the 2 years started to run.
The 2 years started to run when the memo came out, because the sister who hired the private investigator didn't know about the statement that was taken even until the time that the memo came out, because the private investigator took the statement. And then what happened was, after the private investigator took the statement of Roxanne Otterness, he went to get corroborating evidence, because—
Except he took the statement in 2016, as I read the record.
I thought it was 2017, but I mean—
In any event, it's more than two years.
October 21st, 2017. So what happened is, he didn't come out with the memo until a year later, after he felt like he was done with his investigation. In other words, he didn't write the memo, and he didn't send the memo to his client or to the attorneys until a while later. It wasn't quite a year, but a while later, until he felt like he had corroborating evidence and had exhausted the evidence that he could find. So it was an ongoing and continuing process, and my client couldn't have known about it. His attorney couldn't have known about it. And the state wants to, I think it's ironic, as I said in my brief, the state wants to say, you can't take a statement that was admitted out of court and you can't attribute it to us. But then I try to say, I've got a situation here where I got a statement, you know, no, they want us, or a situation where they want to attribute to the attorney and to my client who's sitting in jail something that was done by his sister in a separate deal with a private investigator. There's no
proof anywhere. Well, if the state is the agent of the victim, why isn't your sister the agent of your client?
Because she did it independently. He didn't hire her. She didn't believe he was guilty. She did it of her own accord. Does the state have any proof otherwise that she didn't do it of her own accord? And frankly, maybe the statement is enough in October 21st, 2017, but it's debatable that maybe he had to get the other statements, the private investigator to do a due standard of care for the private investigator. He has to do his due standard of care, follow up, and he contacted the witnesses mentioned in this statement before he wrote a memo and put it out, which is the only responsible thing that any private investigator could do, would be to follow up with his leads before he lays it out on the table. That doesn't even make any sense to not follow up with those leads. It would be actually incompetent and improper for a private investigator to take this statement, completely just take it and not try, at least attempt to confirm some of the stuff with some other witnesses. I think that's clear, right? I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Well, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal whether you reserve time or not.
Oh, I will. Okay.
I'm not encouraging you to continue arguing if you finished your argument. You certainly can leave some time on the table if you like.
Just the state cites a Flournoy, and there was a threat of death in that case, so it's distinguishable. He cites State versus Nix. That is distinguishable because the victim was deceased. The victim was actually a murder victim. In this case, we're talking about an admission by the victim. And I said in my initial brief, which I'd like to include in this today, and I think it is true, what I say on page Roman numeral 5, in other words, if a wrongly convicted person can't get a second chance, which an actual admission of the purported victim who lied, then a victim could plot the lie, take someone's freedom, and then boast about it without consequence. And that's really what I think we're looking at in this case. The victim, according to the statements of everyone, was, and I know more than you do, and I don't have this in the record, but she was a meth head. So he doesn't go, they go back into the bar, he won't buy more drinks.
So we're clear, when you say you know more than we do, and you don't have it in the record, why don't you stick to the record? Because what's in your head doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, she was an alcoholic at the very least, which that is established in the record. And my point is that somebody who's in the mental state of being an alcoholic, which I know this because I've seen alcoholism in my family, people who are in that state of mind, as all of us know, if any of us have been impacted by people who are drug addicted or alcohol addicted, they can do things that are extremely vindictive or wrongful just because they're angry about some little tiny thing. And in this case, the statement by Roxanne Otterness says, yeah, she was angry that he has sex with her. And after he has sex with her, then he says, I don't want, or I'm not going to buy any more drinks. So basically he was saying to her, I used you. I just used you. And so the statement by Roxanne Otterness now confirmed has, that's additional corroborating stuff. And then allegedly the victim said that she was interested in a relationship with this individual, with my client. So she states she's interested in a relationship, then he won't buy her drinks. So clearly he just used her. So right there, it gives all the corroborating circumstances where this statement was made at the aunt's house, why she did it, and what was said. I think it's, I think it should be admissible. That's all I have.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for the state.
Thank you, Your Honors. Juliana Passy, Assistant Candy Rye County Attorney on behalf of the state. In this case, the district court correctly concluded that Mr. Juarez was not entitled to an evidentiary hearing on his petition for post-conviction relief because the files and the record clearly and unequivocally show that he is not entitled to relief. For two reasons we've already discussed. First, the petition is untimely, and none of his proffered evidence constitutes newly discovered evidence under the case law. Therefore, the state respectfully requests that this court affirm. Before I get too much of my argument, we've gone pretty far astray from what the record actually is in this case. The record that was submitted to the post-conviction court is pretty limited. Specifically, it was that memorandum and then the transcript. Mr. Dahl has referred to several reasons why his client may or may not have known about the memorandum. Who hired the private investigator is not a part of the record. And that is key in this case because timeliness, if there is a case that is untimely, a petition that is filed untimely, which this petition undisputedly is, they're only arguing the newly discovered evidence exception. So of course, 2 years from when the newly discovered evidence is found, and the
but is found by whom?
Well, known or should have been known to the appellant, to Mr. Juarez, and that's the question here.
But the state doesn't have any evidence that he knew or even should have known. I mean, this was his sister. Mr. Juarez is sitting in prison. So isn't that a pretty open question then?
Well, it's not, Your Honor, because the burden is on the defendant or the appellant, the post-conviction petitioner, to prove that an exception to the time bar is met under the Wayne v. First State case cited in my brief, 912 Northwest 2nd, 633 from Minnesota, 2018. So the burden is placed on the criminal defendant in this case to provide such evidence in the record, which he has not done here. In fact, all we have in the record for evidence is the memorandum of the private investigator, which of course was not attached to any affidavit or any other kind of sworn statement. And then there's the transcript of the hearing, which again was just submitted. So we have statements that are not notarized, not sworn in any way. And we're expected, it's petitioner's burden to show that he has met the exception that he, of the 2 year time bar. And here he didn't show that because he knew or should have known based on certainly the evidence that his argument relies on is that October 21st, 2017 interview with Ms. Otterness, which is 2 years, more than 2 years before he filed his post-conviction relief. petition. And he's essentially asking this court to read in that he didn't know, he had no reason to know that this was going on. Of course, that's not part of the record, and the burden is on him as the post-conviction petitioner. Therefore, I think the time bar issue is dispositive of this motion. The court need go no further than that. Of course, if the court goes on to the newly discovered evidence issue, this case, I think, is fairly shut, open and shut as well on that issue. As to the Otterness statement, the Florney case, of course, there are different facts, but it's the Florney case is talking about when recantations can come in after trial. And Florney tells us recantations, courts look on disfavor unless there's extraordinary or unusual circumstances. Here, there are none such circumstances. The State versus Nix case tells us that recantations come in if the district court is reasonably well satisfied that the testimony given was false. The defendant was taken by surprise. Certainly he wasn't taken by surprise here that she was going to testify that she had been sexually assaulted by Mr. Juarez. That was, of course, the main point of the charges being brought. And there is no, certainly the district court was not reasonably well satisfied that the testimony given by the victim at trial was false. Again, all we have here is Ms. Otterness's statement, which is, of course, attached. It's only in this this hearsay statement, which is hearsay within hearsay, because we have on testified to exhibits that are not sworn to the district court. Mr. Dahl here on appeal is arguing that the victim is the state's alter ego. Certainly there's no case law on that point in this state. And certainly that doesn't, as a matter of fact, doesn't make necessarily sense. I would argue that certainly there are times when the state acts in manners that are contrary to what the victim wants, often potentially in domestic violence cases. Certainly this is not a statement against interest, as we've discussed. The victim, there's no showing that the victim was unavailable to testify. And moreover, this is merely impeaching evidence, which is not enough to satisfy the newly discovered evidence rule. The other statements as well, Scheffler and Onstead, provide no reason. They're not inconsistent in any way. They're not newly discovered evidence that couldn't have been shown at trial. They're not relevant to the question of whether the victim was sexually assaulted by Mr. Juarez. Whether or not she's an alcoholic really doesn't play any part of that. And even the statements on whether or not she was an alcoholic don't specifically deal to, was she an alcoholic at the time of the sexual assault, which of course at this point happened quite a long time ago. In conclusion, very few of the requirements for the newly discovered evidence test are met here for any of the testimony that's proffered. The district court, in its thorough and well-reasoned order, specifically, you know, dealt with these issues and correctly concluded that this petition is time-barred and that no newly discovered evidence was proffered by the petitioner. The state would ask that you affirm unless the court has any further questions.
Doesn't appear as if any panel member has an additional question, so thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I do have some rebuttal. I reviewed the entire, the things I submitted in this case were the statement of Roxanne Otterness taken by a licensed private investigator, Michael Grostian. And she says there's no statement, but I'm an officer of the court and I've made a statement in my pleadings specifically stating that I've reviewed this stuff, I investigated, and I've spoken to my client, and I can say it. And if I need to file a declaration or have my client file a declaration, I don't know why that's a problem. If they're going to make a technicality on the guilt or innocence of an individual, I will fix
that. Excuse me. The difference between what is and what is not evidence has never been something that I've considered a quote technicality. Is there something that is against due process for the court to require actual evidence rather than just a lawyer making unsworn representations?
I think this is evidence. I think that we have a licensed private investigator that took a statement from a witness.
Well, why don't you point us to some authority that would support your personal view that this is evidence?
I think I have pointed to evidence. I think my whole brief has. In fact, I want to get on to.
Well, let me be more.
I want to make a record on some things.
Let me be more specific than just pointing to your brief. Would you tell us what case or statute supports your representation that a lawyer's oral comments constitute evidence?
Well, this wasn't taken in a district court where we were taking evidence. There wasn't an evidentiary hearing. So this was done not under those circumstances. So,
under any circumstances, would you please cite to us the authority that supports the proposition that you've just made?
I don't have any authority, Your Honor. If that's what you're asking today, I would have to research that and look up that authority. I'm making the point to you that I am an officer of the court. I'm making those representations today. And I think that these issues should be handled at a hearing. I want to note that I've included the order from the district court in this case. And the district court basically says in this case that there's just absolutely no evidence that would convince him that this guy was not guilty. And that's on page A16. And to be honest with you, in this case, there was no physical evidence. And I mean zero. Zero. There wasn't a mark on her arm. There wasn't any evidence of rough sex or anything otherwise. The state didn't introduce a doctor or anything. So this was a he said, she said case. And because this is a he said, she said case, the slightest little thing could tip the balance in this case. Not only that, the lawyer foolishly waived a jury trial. I don't know why a lawyer would ever waive a jury trial. I mean, on AA27, the judge says, even if the evidence is true, it doesn't show he's innocent. And I think that I've shown, and that's my argument, under 804B3, the declarations against interest are evidence. They're accepted from the hearsay rule. And not only are they accepted from the hearsay rule, the declarant can be unavailable for multiple reasons. In fact, if the victim in this case were to testify, she would have to refuse to testify under the Fifth Amendment if the statements made by Roxanne Otterness were true, because she would have to lie to do that. So she would be clearly unavailable. I think the case, frankly,
when you say there was no physical evidence, my understanding is that the victim had bruises, scratches, and cuts on her body.
There was nothing significant enough to even have a doctor testify.
Okay, so bruises, scratches, and cuts are not evidence.
I don't know that. From what I saw in the record that I reviewed, I didn't see anything that appeared out of everyday ordinary stuff.
Well, I'm not asking for your medical opinion. I'm asking you for what's in the record. I'm asking you a question now, Mr. Dahl.
Yep.
Does the record confirm or not confirm that there were bruises, scratches, and cuts on the victim's body?
There was nothing more than minor stuff that could have happened.
So the answer is yes, there was evidence of bruises, scratches, and cuts, but Mr. Dahl considers them minor. Is that accurate or not accurate?
They were minor. They weren't significant enough to prove anything, or let alone a doctor to come in and say, oh yeah, this is consistent with a rape.
Thanks, Mr. Dahl. Your time has expired. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. And the matter is submitted, and we'll take it under advisement, issuing our opinion within due course.